Welcome to the Modern Woodworkers Association, a podcast about woodworking from folk who woodwork. Woodworking is what we do, who we are, and what we like to talk about. So join us as we have a drink, sit around, and talk woodworking.
Hi, and welcome to the 287th episode of the Modern Woodworkers Association podcast. I'm Kyle Barton of K. Barton Tools, and I'm here with my co-host, Diami Plotke of the Penultimate Woodshop, and Sean's with Snoozki, easy for me to say,
News-
of the corner, with Snoozki of the corner workshop. And tonight we're just talking amongst ourselves. So, how y'all doing?
Great. How are you?
Fantastic. Except... little bad news out there.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I mean, come right in with it, man. Just lead.
I know. Well, in case someone listens to this years from now, they can just skip forward this part.
But so. I promise you, on March 13th, 2020, this is very relevant.
Yes. As exactly. We record this is incredibly relevant.
So, talking, of course, about the coronavirus, COVID-19.
Or NCOVE, I've seen it designated as well.
You kids out in Ohio, you just have your own way of doing things.
No. That was from some other source. Anyway.
Well, let's talk about that. So a bunch of woodworking events have been canceled. I know the woodworking shows are canceled. Lee Nielsen is canceling their events. But probably close to home for us is Fine Woodworking Live got canceled, which was due to be April 17th through 19th. So
right around the corner. It was like four weeks away, something like that.
So, you know, so I had to go in I think the hotel rooms were automatically canceled, but I went ahead and called them and made sure.
I was very impressed by that because as we're recording this on Friday night, it's a odd time for us to record. This morning, as I was getting up for work at the ungodly hour of about 4:30, I checked my email, as I usually do while I'm letting the dogs out, and that was the email I'd gotten overnight, was them canceling Fine Woodworking Live.
Right.
And by the time I next checked my email at work, at least my personal email, which was probably somewhere between 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning, I'd already gotten the email from the hotel saying that it was canceled. So I had been prepared to call them, but I thought that was just very well coordinated between the hotel and the conference. Now, it probably helps that the hotel is the conference center, so they know that it's being canceled. But if you're going to cancel an event, I thought that was a very nice way to do it so that the attendees don't get stuck having to go and deal with their own hotel room or maybe the inability to cancel it or they forget to cancel it or all those things that can happen if they're independent things.
Right. Yeah, I was just, you know, belt and suspenders on that. But since they did state it would automatically be canceled. But yeah, and also today I got an email saying that my my funds are being refunded back to me. So said it might take 2 or 3 days. But, you know, in their email, they said it might be, you know, 3 to 4 weeks. And it was just the next day I got an email saying it should be in your account in a couple of days.
Yeah, that is very good. And I mean, this is in response to obviously the pandemic we're currently dealing with. God willing, by the time anybody hears this, that it gets just getting better every day. And it's soon to be history. What?
This is going to post in 10 hours.
I know. Okay. I know. But somebody might catch it next week and they go, man, it's so much better.
That's absolutely true. And to all of you in the future, I hope you're healthy.
Everyone in the future, I hope everyone's doing well. I don't know on a state-by-state basis. I know, you know, the president has made statements. In my state of Ohio, they've limited anything to groups of 100 being the cutoff limit of any events. Down to the high school spring sports have been canceled or at least postponed indefinitely. They don't want any of that going on. You know, our kids have a 3-week spring break starting now.
Wow.
They're cutting it off immediately and just trying to react, you know, just to, you know, slow this spread. Now,
this is a very on-topic woodworking question for that. But I know like in New York State, I think it would require a change of law to actually reduce the number of school days. So if that were to happen to us, I believe they would have to add 2 weeks to the end of this calendar. Do
so
you guys
what
have
they,
that same scenario?
Well, yeah, no, it should be.
Well,
it's not.
Well, it's they're dealing with it differently, and I don't know, you know, they're dealing with it. You know, so something we have, and I, Tommy, you might, Kyle, I doubt you do down there, but we've got calamity days built into the schedule.
We have snow days. We don't call them calamities because we're rational New Yorkers. But
well, so
apocalypse days.
You call them snow days, but it was 4, 5, 6 years ago where right off of Christmas break. A wicked system came through and it was negative 10 or lower actual temperature without wind chill. And that held off 2 weeks of school.
Wow.
Of starting back up. And it was just wicked. And, you know, it's like, oh, you know, students walking and all this other stuff, which is why it wasn't that the roads were bad. It wasn't that the snow was covering. It was the fact that the conditions were non-safe.
Right. But
and go ahead.
You don't build 2 weeks of those into the calendar, do you? Like we have like three, I think.
No, that's it. So they've got like, maybe 8, maybe 10 days, and different school systems have it differently. And we're right on the border of Michigan and they do it differently. But what they did at that time, and my kids were in grade school, but they were sending home packets. And here is a workbook for you to work on, you know, for that time to make up that work. And there was a way to equivalate the time in school with work being done. So you didn't have to go over into the summer.
That's interesting.
So, that's what they've done for this. So junior high up in our school system all have access to Chromebooks and they use the Google Classroom. So they made announcements and we asked our kids when they got home today, what is it? Oh, you know, well, English has this reading and this has this. And so there's work for them to complete while they're away, which should keep them on the learning path in some creditable way to make them not go deep into summer, you know, making up days of school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, we've had similar things like that down here. Yeah. We don't have the snow days or if it ever does snow. Yeah. No one's going anywhere.
Well, yeah. If it does snow, you're shit out of luck. Right?
Well, everyone's going to go play in it for one thing, but no, they do have calamities down here, I guess. You know, we have hurricanes and stuff like that.
Sure.
And Hurricane Harvey, you know, shut down, you know, entire schools. Hey, yeah, it's going to take us a couple of years to rebuild this school. So, you know, they do a lot of work from home and then reassign them to other schools. But yeah, so I think.
Yeah, so in times like this where they're having the kids stay home, it's an effort to to limit exposure. It's kind of directly in line with what the colleges are doing, which, you know, and again, I can't speak to the states that you live in, but our lovely governor came out Tuesday of this week, I think. So relatively early. And this has all kind of gotten out of hand quickly. But he basically said we're under, you know, declared the state in a state of emergency and to limit this and limit this. And then subsequently, you know, you see it was way beyond. I mean, the colleges were starting their spring break and they were saying there will be no face to face classroom anything through the end of March. So you know, just you go do your spring break. When you come back, you're not to report to school. You should be on your computer doing whatever online, and they're going to work to do that.
I need to, in that regard, I need to actually give a shout out to my sister-in-law, who she works for a university, and her job is to facilitate the professors creating and dealing with online courses and some other computer stuff too, but that's really the crux of it. And she went from having the majority of her professors like turn their nose up and say, like, why would I do that? To in 2 weeks, the university is going exclusively online for the rest of the semester.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And in our case, I just heard that's happened today. Ohio State University, big school, big state university. Everyone's heard of that one, I hope. I hate them, but anyway,
don't hold back.
no, it's fine. But they have, I think, as I understand it, 'cause I have a neighbor whose son is down there. They have told students to not return to dorms for the rest of the year. They're
dorms
just
are where all the fun happens. You don't want to live
well,
on campus.
Dorms where all the meningitis and other viral spreads happen. So we're trying to limit that at this point.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is, you know, at Fine Woodworking Live, I think listeners know, and certainly y'all know, is that, you know, I was going to take a class with David DeYard afterwards.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was going to ask about that.
Friend of the show.
For the show, are you, is that, what is the status of that class, Kyle?
Well, I went ahead and canceled since I wasn't flying up there. You know, I'd have to rejigger everything. So I canceled my Airbnb and went ahead and canceled the class. But, you know, Fine Woodworking's already announced classes next, they're the conference next year. They already got dates and everything. So, well, we're probably just going to do a little repeat of that. But that, of course, that gives me another year to talk one of y'all or Brian into taking the class with me.
Well, I'll be honest. I don't know that I'm going to take the class next year because I already have like 2 weeks of summer crap going on next year. But
yeah,
next year, to be completely selfish, next year is better for me than this year.
There you go.
So I hope that next year I can at least spend the extra day with you and like just hang out for a day or two outside of the stuff. As I know we were trying to do this year, but was not looking good for it.
Well, that reminds me, you know, David reached out to me and was like, hey, what are you doing the Friday before? And I said, you know, nothing. In fact, I was flying in on Thursday because I get cheaper airline flights. And he had set up a thing with the Yale Furniture Study for us.
Oh, my goodness.
To go there. And, you know, they have all the chairs and all kinds of furniture.
But I literally think they have all the chairs.
They have all, antiques from going, you know, colonial days and pre-colonial days. And so I was really excited about doing that. But they called earlier this week and said, yep, we're canceling that. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, darn it. But I hope that I can do all that next year or so.
Well, I don't mean to cut this short, but I think we should hope that everyone stays safe and healthy, and if anyone does get sick, as they're predicting many of us will, that it ends up passing with just minor flu symptoms and no one has any drastic medical issues. And to anyone who does, we certainly wish you the best. Right now, there's no virus in my shop, so let's get going.
Yes, exactly. So, Diami, so last episode we did you couldn't make it, but we didn't get your thoughts about Wood Talk coming back.
Well,
do they now count as the longest running? They can't be the longest continually running podcast.
Clearly, we are forever the longest continually running woodworking podcast. Okay. So I am in complete agreement. When you quit, you cannot consider yourself continually running. It's a fact.
It's a new show. They got a new logo.
I'm not sure. The new logo is great.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of like fixing something that wasn't broken. Like, that's a classic. When my old Wood Talk logo shirt got a little hole in it, I went and bought a new Wood Talk logo shirt because you need to have a Wood Talk logo shirt. Yeah. I hate to think that my shirt is outdated.
Quitting, I bought a new one, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, now it's retro or what do the kids say these days
throwback?
Yeah, I mean,
throwback jersey or throwback.
Right. Yeah. It's like I still drink coffee out of an old Wood Whisperer mug. Like,
you know,
that I got
that was our
in 2009,
the rounded one.
Yes.
It's kind of bulbous in shape.
I have the straight walled white one.
Oh, no. The rounded one.
Well, that was much better.
Yes.
When he started bringing those out for the Woodworking Society Cancer.
Yes, yeah. Yes. That was my wife's favorite mug, and we broke it, and I can't get another one.
Well, I have three of them, so
there you go.
All right, how about this, Kyle?
Mugs too.
Next year, you come up early to Fine Woodworking Live. I will make sure I'm actually able to attend and hang out with you, and you bring me a mug.
Sure. And in return, I get what? A personalized tour of the city?
I will gladly give you that. I'll take you to Yale and show you all the chairs.
All righty.
I will get you the best burrito in New York. How about that?
Nah, the best burrito in New York is not going to do it.
No, what I'll give you is actually really good pizza and Chinese food.
That might work.
Yeah. We'll work that somehow.
It'll work something.
There's a way we can make this work. Absolutely.
But no, to get back to Wood Talk, I'm glad to see them back. It's
I got a chance to listen to not the most recent episode, but the one before where they were talking about what's changed in 10 years. And I rather enjoyed that. That was a cool kind of you know, I like the pacing of it and the kind of quickfire format. And I've understood from you, Kyle, that they're not all the same yet. They're
right. They're, everyone's a little different. So yeah.
Which I don't. Yeah, I've got another one in the chamber. I think
I'm a week behind you, Sean.
Okay,
because I'm about 2 weeks behind in my podcast listening right now. And the formats have all been a little different, but as much as they're different, they're also the same.
Yeah,
I think, you know, Mark runs a ship the way Mark runs a ship, and it's still going to be Mark's ship. And I mean that in the best possible way. That's not a derision on Mark, but you know what you're getting when Mark is involved in producing it, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree.
No, more power to him. And you know what, guys? Hopefully the next time you quit, it's a little bit longer so we can catch up an episode number. But, but you know, keep coming back.
Exactly. Well, next up on the list, friend of the show, and Sean, I'll let you say the last name.
It's Bob Rozieski. You can make the zh sound on the z if you want.
Yeah, I know. He's been on the show, but I still look at the, when I look at the name, I go,
it's just Bob.
It's just Bob. Bob. Or as some might know him better, BR Fine Furniture.
Yeah. I'm not as scared as your name, but of course I mispronounced it already once today. So
yeah, you did.
But anyway, so but he has updated his website. So that's brfinewoodworking.com. So you might want to go out there and check it out. You know, he's been doing this for a long time, and he's kind of organized everything into articles, audio, video, and so it's a real great resource. And you can also subscribe to the website. So if he when he publishes new content, you can get an email.
I'm on the website now, and it is a very modern, clean, and well-defined website. And I would agree that things are going to be very easy to find on it. But when we talked to him, I know he was slowing down from actually creating new content. Is the new website simply a resource to make the existing content more findable and usable? Or does he actually have the intention of continuing making new content?
Yeah, I think he's going to continue making new content, but more in the, like, the articles.
Actually writing a blog.
And yeah, exactly. And a little bit on videos and stuff as it comes up. So, he's definitely making some new content also. But, you know, anyone that's into hand woodworking, this should definitely be on bookmarked in a couple of different places.
when I was getting into more handworking, I was definitely I was best referencing his production stuff back in a decade ago. You know, it's been a while.
Right. Yeah, so it's nice to see it all in one place that you can get to really easily. So anyway, again, that's brfinewoodworking.com.
Is that the same website he had, or is it actually a new URL?
No, it's the same website.
It's just the actual site is updated, but the address is the same.
Yeah.
Okay, then definitely worth checking out.
That's the easy way to do it. Yes. You don't have to rebrand, repoint, re anything. It's same place as it always was, just with the new coat of paint.
Yeah. So I just wanted to give you all a quick update. So last episode I talked about Lost Art Press's new book by Chris Williams, Good Work, The Chairmaking Life of John Brown. And there's a question in there that came up because I had just started the book, and Aspen asked us, why do they call them Welsh stick chairs?
Oh, I asked that.
Maybe it was you.
I said, wait. Is it? Go ahead.
No. I'll let you finish, but I want to answer before Kyle does because I think I know.
So my question
I just wanted to say the answer is in the book.
Yeah, good. So my question, Diami, was are all Welsh chairs stick chairs? So why could they just be called stick chairs and not necessarily Welsh stick chairs? Or could they just be called Welsh chairs because they're all stick backed?
Okay. I'm going to put on my snooty I don't make winter chairs hat.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to say it's a little worn, but go on.
It's a good hat though. Every chair made in Wales is a Welsh chair.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I would agree to that.
Okay, I'm going to assume that these are called Welsh stick chairs because of the general form of the chair and the fact that it's made of green wood, which, when picking the grain to get some of the components of the chair out, from what I have learned of generic Winder chair making, and this being a derivative of that style, or maybe a foundation of that style, but still in the same family, is that you're looking for a particular style of grain, straight grain or curved grain, given the component of the chair. So it is a chair that literally sticks become components of. And there's sticks that are transformed with a spoke shave and a draw knife and the different components and tools of making a chair. But a stick is literally an ingredient in making the chair. So is it as literal as it's a chair made of sticks in Wales?
I'm not going to say you're wrong, but I'm not going to say you're right either. I'll just say the answer is in the book.
Okay.
Damn it, I hate reading.
But no, I mean, it would make sense, and I agree. Like, anything made in Ohio is an Ohioan thing, right? I mean, the area defining the thing is right. The area's thing. But if there are different styles within there, I mean, there may be Welsh Windsor chairs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm saying, right? I mean, it could be. And well, so maybe.
Yeah. The one thing I will say about the book is it's nothing like any other woodworking book you've ever read. It is it's much more of a story about a man and making chairs and told from the points of view of various people throughout his life when he was making chairs. And he only made chairs for, you know, just a short, well, not a short, but, you know, not all of his life. I think he was in the Royal Air Force and flew fighter planes and stuff like that, which is alluded to in the book, I think, but not really talked about. But it's more about his chair making and his philosophy. And it's a story more than it is a woodworking, your typical woodworking book. So, you know, of course it has elements of that all in there, but it's quite an interesting and dare I say a beautiful story about you know, the chair making life of John Brown. So it's really good.
So the subtitle that you said it was going to be full of lewd language and inappropriate imagery.
No.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
It's not Welsh.
It's not Welsh.
Well, you know. Yeah, I think you quickly understand that he was married a few times during his life.
Fair.
But I'm not certain that they, you know, you want to you know, you hear about it, but it's not something that's integral to the chair making story.
Fair.
I guess. staying with sort of Lost Art Press.
Can I introduce this before you do, Kyle? Since sure. I will admit my ignorance, and I've only looked at the page like 30 seconds ago. That's why I don't have the background that you do.
Okay.
These are the Lost Art Press Crucible Pinch Rods, which essentially make, I want to call it a story stick, but it's not. It's when you have the two sticks that can slide to create a distance, and they're most often used, I can think of, in making something that's square. So you'd set them to the opposite inside corners and lock them together, and then make sure the other opposite inside corners are the same distance to ensure that what you're making is literally square. I forget what that's necessarily called, but these are...
Checking for square.
Excuse me?
Checking for square.
There you go.
What they're good for.
But the device, not the process, but the actual device.
You can use them for other things too. Yes. But yeah, that's what you're going to see a lot of people use them for, yeah.
These are they look brass, but they're some sort of metal, squares with probably some sort of a lock on one. It's hard to tell from the photo what it is. I've not read anything yet.
Yeah.
And the other one has a knurled knob that locks it down. So these are the components that let you take two... In this case, square stocks that have a bevel on one end to make a sharp point on one so you can get it right into the corner, and slide them against each other and then lock them in to define that distance and check the other square. And when I first saw this, I was like, why in God's name would I need something machined to, I'm sure, an absolutely wonderful standard? Because I'm going to be critical of this, but I don't mean to be critical of Randy because the machining he does is amazing.
Right.
But I'm thinking, why do you need this amazingly machined square thing to just, you know, you could literally blue tape them together. And then I saw the price and I'm like, for $48, if I needed something to be square, I might spend $48 on this. Mm, this is really not a bad price.
And no, it's not.
All of my criticism kind of went away when I saw the price.
Exactly. No, I have a set. Lee
of course
Valley,
you do.
Yeah, Lee Valley used to have something like that. And when I saw that, when I saw this, I went to Lee Valley's website to see if they still have it. I couldn't find it.
It might be a one-time tool, but woodpeckers made something like this, and it was two rods. They were round, but it was all their machined, anodized stuff. And I'm sure they were more than $48.
$48, probably. But no, I thought this is pretty nice. It's a pretty nice little set. And, you have to make your own sticks. I think it's interesting that the ones that they're using are made out of mahogany, it looks like, because sure that's what mine are made out of, too.
So. I bet.
Well, I have – hold on. I'm sorry. I have to take my headphones off. Hold on a second.
But it is a nice little tool, and they are invaluable. Once you start using them, it's just like, oh yeah, this is much better than trying to do tape measure. And you can even use them for other things like checking distances between legs and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah,
is this a case where any Dick, Tom, or Harry could use blue tape, but you, dear listener, deserve better, and this quality of the machining of these components and the wonderful precision it will add and enjoyment it will add to your crafting of objects that are in square will make your work infinitely more valuable and add an infinite amount of enjoyment to your process. So you'd be a fool not to spend $48 on these.
So while not requiring a fine violinist's dexterity to pinch two sticks together, to pinch in the corners of your box and then blue tape them around them without them shifting might be a little more difficult than it is to slide them in a captured set of things with a nut to tighten it down. It would add a slight ease to the operation.
I would agree. I would actually agree with that. And
there is more of a benefit than just the aesthetics.
One of them is it looks like it's under spring tension. And the other one is a knurled knob. So you kind of, you line it up, it holds itself, and then you twist the knurled knob to lock it in. Is that the case?
That appears to be. Kyle, can you tell us?
Yeah, you're the one who's read it, Kyle.
I actually have something similar. Yeah. The one with the knurled knob, lets one piece of wood slide in and out and locks it down. The other one, is locked into the other piece of wood. It's steady there. So,
Now,
it works well. Now, there is a trick that I use when I'm making chairs. So if you got two legs and you've drilled your spindle holes and then you need to measure to see how long your spindle holes are, is this one won't really work because it's going to be too big to actually fit into the spindle holes. But you can take two bamboo skewers and put them in either spindle hole. Hopefully this is making sense. Mm-hmm. And then when you hold them together, you just put a little pencil mark on both of them. So then you can put it back together.
Okay.
Yeah. So
pencil mark easier than blue tape.
Easier than blue tape. And plus you can get the skewers then out of the spindle holes.
That too. Yes. Yeah. Cause removing them in that case where you're spanning between two penetrations you need to take them apart before you get them out of there or you stuck.
Yeah. So that's a technique I use. And I think Curtis Buchanan is, I don't know if he came up with it, but that's who I first saw using it.
From a technical perspective, would a round one still wouldn't let you do that. So the fact that it's square and a little wide doesn't really impact.
The thing is you're going into two mortises basically. Right. So you got to be able to back it out. And then, if this was made small enough, it would do, but you would still have to put some sort of mark between the two to put it back together. But, that's not what these are designed for. These are, designed to, measure distances between things and check for square on cases.
So at this price point, they're flying off the shelves. They're currently not in stock.
Yeah.
How often are they in stock?
They're getting much better. Crucible used to run out of things all the time, but I think they're getting better now. New tools are going to probably run into this, but they are doing a much better job of keeping things in stock. So, but this came out like last week. So yeah, it's going to sell out.
Is Rainey still basically making everything himself, or do they have help keeping everything in stock?
I think they have help they have help, you know, putting stuff together, and I'm not sure, you know, exactly if he's doing everything or not. I haven't kept up with that, but I know that, you know, some of the people like Brendan and Megan and Chris, of course, himself, and I think they got a few others, John and stuff, you know, will help, you know, assemble lump hammers and things of that nature. You know, for instance, lump hammers are in stock, you know, for, you know, a year. Every time they had some, they would immediately sell out. So
do you buy enough with them that you have sway and could get Rainey on? Because he's a joy to chat with.
I don't know. I mean, I know Chris, but I've met Rainey a couple of times, but he would know me from Adam.
Fine Woodworking America 2000 at something. We were in the in the Starbucks in the Covington Convention Center, and I had a 15-minute conversation with Rainey as we waited online in Starbucks next to each other, and he is just an absolute hoot.
He is. Well, yeah, and you know, I don't. It may not be something he wants to do, but sure, we could reach out.
You know? Everyone wants to be.
That's right.
Subjected to this kind of witless banter.
Exactly. But no, I think that's good. That's a good idea to reach out to him and see. So, hey, I ordered a new product from MicroJig.
I
installed it today. It is the MicroJig magnetic dust cover for steel table saws. Now, Ramon Valdez, I want to say about 2 months ago, maybe longer than that, posted something similar. So basically, a MicroJig must have saw that video and said, hey, we could make that. But
you know what? Ramon is wonderful. But this is that magnetic cover over that slot was in an article on Fine Woodworking on how to dustproof a contractor's table saw.
At least
a decade ago. And I literally have my slot covered with a Renaissance woodworker magnet.
So that's all it is. It's just the thing to put over the hole.
Right. Yeah. Because
for your arbor bevel swing. Yeah.
The trick to dust collection in a table saw is having good suction. And
you got so many holes.
Exactly. Cabinet saws have poor suction. Contractor saws basically just blow. This is a good, easy way to close off a giant gaping hole in the front of your saw. Mm-hmm. And because it's a magnet, it adjusts because that whole your crank there needs to swing through the whole hole as you adjust the angle of your blade. You need a magnet. You can't just permanently fill it unless you're only going to cut 90s and make square things. In which case, you should probably buy the crucible adjustable things because they'll help you make it square.
Right. He had that post. I go, yeah, I need to do that. And I kept thinking about it. Of course, I never did it. And then I heard about this. I think it might have been on Mark's morning show. What are they calling Friday? Yeah, I think it might have been on that, but I'm not sure. And I went out to MicroJig's website, and it's not anywhere on their website, but it is on Amazon. And it's only $8 as of today, $8.77.
I put one in my cart as we've been talking. It's cheap not to buy.
Exactly. So that's something out there. So, you know, like y'all were saying, this is just it's basically the same stuff. They make those magnetic cards you get in the mail from the insurance or realtors. It's basically that same material. And just like you said, fits over where your arbor swings.
My dad's got a birthday coming up and he's got a PM66 table saw. That might work nicely.
There you go.
We won't tell him what it costs. It looks.
Yeah.
It looks cheap.
It looks inexpensive,
but it's not cheap. I'm sure it's very well magnetized.
Yeah, it does have that picture on it. You know, I might have paid another dollar or two to have something that was just black.
Yes, that.
You could always get some 3M spray adhesive and put a different picture on it.
Yeah,
probably. You want me to mail you a picture of me?
Or no picture. It could just be a white-backed magnet. It could be a bear magnet.
It could.
I don't really care.
You could draw a picture of dust particles.
There you go.
Oh. I'm sorry, guys. It's Friday night. I'm a little slap happy.
It's fine.
Hey, that's fine.
It's fine. It's fine. So that's really cool, and that is an approachable little accessory to just better your shop. That's kind of cool.
If you don't have dust collection, I'm not sure if it makes any sense. But if you have dust collection on your saw, it is a no brainer. For $9, why wouldn't you just slap it on? It's going to improve your dust collection immensely.
And it's not that if you have just a massive dust collector, if you've got a shop vac hooked up, this will help.
Absolutely. If you just lean over the saw and blow, it's going to help. So be careful. You don't want to lean into the blade.
No, yes. Not when it's running. No, bad. Anyway, who's got the M12 Milwaukee?
You can't see me, but I'm raising my hand.
You. Hey, Diami, you.
Yes. All right. So years ago, Festool introduced the CXS, which is this tiny little, I want to say it's 12 volt. It's not 18 volt. I think it's 12 volt. It's a little thing. And the Festool fanatics out there will have to forgive me if I'm incorrect in this, but I believe it's made for cabinet makers. It's a driver. It's not a proper drill.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it's made for cabinet makers because it comes with a number of replaceable tips, which give you chucks. They give you an eighth inch quick release, but it's the wacky Festool eighth inch quick release. It doesn't fit anybody else's. Mm. It gives you an offset driver, and it gives you a right angle driver, which when you're putting in like drawer slides and different components inside cabinetry is really handy.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at this thing. I said, wow, that's really cool. And I bought one. And I pulled the trigger, and I realized it had zero torque, and I sold it. Now, okay, it's for cabinets, for putting in screws. It's not for driving tapcons into concrete. I understand that.
Right.
But I have a range of Milwaukee and Makita 18-volt tools Milwaukee 12-volt tools. And certainly the 18-volts are in a different class than the 12s, but even the 12s, they have some power. And like putting my fence together, I used probably more 12-volt tools than 18-volt. Compared to what I was already used to in the 12-volt world, the Festool was, in my opinion, very underpowered. And that's why I got rid of it, because I couldn't drive like inch and a half stainless steel screws that I would use for cabinet construction. I couldn't drive them with this thing. It was underpowered. And unless they've changed it, it remains underpowered. It is not worth buying.
And for visual clarity, it's the Festool drill that has the extra piece in front of your hand as you're holding it that comes down kind of
exactly.
Near where,
it's like a sheath, so when you get into a sword fight, your knuckles don't get cut.
There it is. There it is. Yeah, that's it.
That's the Festool drill. Fast forward to a few months ago, maybe in like November or December of last year, Makita. No, I keep confusing them. I apologize. It's Milwaukee. It's the red one.
Yeah.
Milwaukee brings out what, as best I can tell, is an absolute equivalent. It's 12 volt. It's the same format with that weird thing in front of your fingers, though at least in the Festool, the battery had this vertical component that slid up into that. The Milwaukee just uses the regular Milwaukee batteries that fit in the handle, so I don't know why the Milwaukee put it there other than to copy the design of the Festool.
Some advantage.
Yeah, it has a little magnetic catch, but that's not particularly helpful.
Ergonomics.
Yeah. So the Milwaukee has the same quick release tips. Maybe it's not the same mechanism, but from a practical functional standpoint, it's identical. So I picked up the Milwaukee thinking that's a useful tool, and all things being equal, I've yet to be disappointed by a Milwaukee cordless tool that I own, and it's half the price of the Festool. The Milwaukee 12-volt stuff I have is certainly powerful enough, unlike the Festool, so let me try this out. So I picked one up around Christmas time, and I'm going to give it the most qualified positive review I can, in that it is better than the Festool, but not worth buying.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's better than the Festool in that it seems to have an appropriate amount of torque and power. I've been able to drive, you know, small 1-2-inch screws, nothing crazy. Maybe cabinet makers are thinking, well, you should be driving a 3/8-inch screw. I'm not doing anything small like that. But in my opinion, a 12-volt drill should be able to drive a 2-inch screw, and this does that. I have done things with the offset head that are truly helpful because the offset head puts the driver right on the edge of the shape of the body where you have to put it like up against a cabinet wall or something. Or I was actually fixing the stands for our flags for Boy Scouts, and we have a pipe that comes up that ends up being the female receiver of the flagpole that drops down in it. Mm-hmm. And the flange that gets screwed down to the base, the pipe is right next to where the screw hole goes, and I couldn't do it without the offset tip, and I snapped the offset tip on, and it was a breeze, and it was really helpful. But that's just as helpful with the Festool. But again, the Milwaukee is more powerful, and that's a benefit, and it's half the price. And that's a benefit. But the negatives, which is why I would say it's still not something I could recommend you buy unless you truly need one of these heads it has, the right angle, the offset. Because the regular Chuck Eddy drill has that, so that's not necessarily a benefit. Couple things is that in Milwaukee 12-volt, they make a larger battery that has like a square base that sticks out from the handle, and they have a smaller battery that's kind of it's a rounded triangle shape that fits in the handle. And then hopefully listeners are familiar with that.
Yeah.
So if you use the smaller battery, then that weird guard thing that comes down in front of your hand and the battery make a level base, and you can rest it like on the base of the drill, as you can like most 18-volt drills that have a big fat battery in the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If you use the bigger battery, which is what I have most of and what I use more often, because they last longer, then that weird front guard thing doesn't hit the ground and it tips forward and you can't rest it on its base. You have to put it on its side, which is a little inconvenient. I understand they have two different battery styles. Have a pop-out foot, for God's sakes. Like, just do something. If you're going to use this thing a lot, you're going to want the bigger battery, and the bigger battery makes it less useful, and that's a problem.
Yeah, all the pictures I've seen so far do not show it with the big battery. Yeah, it's the small one.
The small battery, it works conveniently with a small battery. But as I said, like, I probably have 5 or 6 of the big batteries and 3 of the small batteries. Like, excuse me. Whenever I've bought a battery, I only buy the big ones, because why wouldn't you? Everything else rests on the big battery because they don't have that silly front thing to balance on. And the big battery just lasts longer. So that's one thing. The other thing is it has, rather than having a switch, a physical switch that moves it from forward to reverse, it has a push button on the top that's digital. And I don't particularly care that it's digital. That doesn't really bother me. But it has a light to indicate whether it's in forward or reverse. And what I have discovered through use is that while I can see that light just fine in my shop, and if all I'm making is kitchen cabinets, that's fine. The minute you go outside, you can't see the light. It's not bright enough. So I was using it actually at work. Anyone who saw the Instagram post I made under the MWA account, just as we were recording, I was showing the Bosch jigsaw that's on my workbench right now. On my workbench. It's on the top of the entertainment center. It's where it is. What I didn't show is that there's a couple of holes drilled through the foot of that saw, because we had to make this curved edge at work, and I bought the saw for work to make the curved edge, and I made a rounded wooden thing that screwed underneath it to act as a guide, and then we cut through it. That's not really the point, but because I was there making the curve, because no one else knows how to make curves properly, because we're roofers, not cabinet makers, I had this drill with me, and the drill was fine in terms of its power. I was driving 1 5/8 and 2 1/4 inch wood screws. It drove them no problem, but I could not tell if I was in forward or reverse. I literally realized I needed to pull the trigger to tell what direction I was in before I could drill down, because the light was you could not see the light. It was February in New York, so it wasn't particularly bright, but it was impossible to see the light. And I think that's probably an oversight, because my guess is that they never tested it outside, because it's really not designed for outside use. But then again, unless we're talking to a professional cabinet maker, this is going in your homeowner's tools, and you're going to use it a little bit everywhere. And it's useful to know that you can't see this light outside. Whereas if you have a traditional throw switch, you can tell whether it's in forward or reverse without having to, like, you know, cup it with your hand or watch the end spin. So that's a big negative.
Yeah, my hand is conditioned to use the, you know, like, gun safety style. Index finger pushes it in, it's going forward, thumb pushes it back, it's going in reverse. I know exactly what that's doing. That's weird to make it, to change that. Now, the only other one I've seen change is a driver that my dad has, which is a DeWalt, and it was a it was a gyroscopic controlled. So if you twist it to the left, you're unscrewing. If you twist to the right, you're screwing. Electrician's tool, because you're just driving screws into threaded metal
things.
Was
that one of the motorized ones that looks like a screwdriver?
Yeah, and you could, like, twist the handle to make it 90-degree handle.
Gotcha.
Or it could be in line. Yeah. It's a very thin cylinder, naturally. Mm-hmm. But that had this little gyro in it so that you just engage, and when you press it, the bit would go in, and that would be like, I can go now. And if you tilted left, it would drive, and the further you tilted, the more it would drive. And it had a little bit of torque, but not too much, you know, and you could adjust it with its standard kind of torque adjuster. But otherwise, why mess with what really has been largely the standard, as far as I've known in my lifetime?
I mean, would agree.
Yeah, the one I use, I have the Bosch one, the little 12-volt Bosch one. I've got
18, 12, and then the new 12.
Yeah.
I've got the cylindrical 12. The old 12. And then I've got the big fat base 12.
Yeah. But I use it all the time for, you know, driving screws and things like that. And, boy, I've at least had that 12 years, and it still works like a charm. So, but, you know, it's the same form factor as a regular a drill.
Right.
But,
and I have a number of those Milwaukees that are that same form factor. I have a drill and a driver that are that same form factor. And I have the DeWalt, that's the impact gun in the 12 volt, which is a really handy little tool sometimes. And I've been really pleased with all of them, which is what led me to buy this. I was like, well, the form factor is pretty cool. Milwaukee makes nice stuff. I like the 12 volt. I have the 12 volt. Why not get it? And it's not, again, it's more useful than the Festool. It's half the price in the Festool, so I can't say don't buy it. It's not a waste. But unless the special tips really are something you need, it's not a useful addition to your arsenal unless you really need the benefit it provides.
Right. Mm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, my regular drill drivers are Milwaukee. I guess I got a hammer drill. I got a 12-volt and 18-volt and an impact 18.
I may be the odd duck out here, but as I'm looking around my shop, just in the stuff that doesn't fit in my cabinet, you can see three cordless Milwaukees and one cordless Makita.
Yeah, I've been really pleased with the Milwaukees. The chucks are really nice, but I have heard over a lot of use that can be problematic, but it's the never chucks? Bothered. Yeah, the chucks, but I've never had an issue with I'm real gentle on my chucks. I'm not just grabbing them and mashing the drill full throttle to tighten them up.
I usually
do it by hand.
I never had an issue with the chuck. My first Milwaukee 12 volt drill, I blew the clutch in it. But I was drilling, it was like a 3/8 inch drill bit through steel. And the drill bit caught and just went, and that was it. And the clutch broke and I had no power to the chuck. And I was like, you know what? I know I overused the drill, and I can't blame it for that. And I replaced it with a new one, and it's been working fine since. But the actual chuck, I've never had an issue with.
I've heard just one person say that to me, but you know, like I said, I don't want to put a lot of stock into that because that's just one thing, and I've never had an issue with it.
Yeah, I see, and I've been Bosch since the old. When they used to drop the battery off the top of the truck to prove that it was the brute force, whatever, you know, like back in, you know, 10, 15 years ago, whenever that was, I've been Bosch only. Before that, I did have a DeWalt that I bought the next day I went and I was drilling, or I was driving screws. I was putting a set together for a musical and the clutch stripped on it. And I took that thing back and I said, no, I'm never using this thing again. And now, mind you, we're talking like circa 2002, 2000-ish. Right. I mean, it's been a while.
That time frame, 2000, 2002, the DeWalt was king. The Milwaukee's at the time frame sucked.
Yes. The Milwaukee's had sucked, and the Porter cables sucked at the time too. And Bosch was just starting to get better, and you know it was a whatever. And that's why I did. I mean, I walked into Home Depot, I bought this thing. It was like, you know, it was a lower whatever at the time. And but yeah, I just like what, and just walked right through, and I went, what the hell? And I couldn't adjust it back. It was just gone. I said, forget this.
Let me say two things. I want to go back to Milwaukee for a second, because I have a number of their lights. And I bought the lights. One I got for free because I bought a battery, and one I actually paid for. But I have their lights because I have all their batteries, not necessarily because their lights were the best. But I have been really pleased with their lights. And as a unit in Boy Scouts now, we don't use lanterns. We use Milwaukee battery-powered lights because a number of us have them, and they work that well. And they'll last you all weekend. So
that's impressive.
They really are. They're wonderful. But to switch back to the Bosch for a second... I like Bosch as a brand, and the Bosch things I own are very nice. And like I was talking about this jigsaw before, my personal corded jigsaw is an old circa 2001 Porta cable. And it's a tank, but it has no finesse. And I have a Makita 18 volt cordless jigsaw, which I really like. It's the older style. They've updated it with a new one that I've tried and don't like. But I have the older one. It's made in England, of all places. And it weighs a ton without the battery. But it is a really well-made jigsaw. Since I've owned that, I've bought a Festool Carvex jigsaw and said, this is crap, and sold it. The Makita cordless is better than the Festool, hands down. But this Bosch, I got it for work because we were cutting this curve and I knew I had to drill a bunch of holes through the foot, so we put it in the course of the job. And it's probably going to go back to work, but I have been pleased with the use of this Bosch. And I've only heard good things about Bosch jigsaws. But the Bosch cordless tools, the handle strikes me as abnormally fat and just slightly uncomfortable to hold. Do you find that, or are you just used to them?
I'm used to them, maybe. I have no problem. Although hand sizes vary. I was a piano player and I could cover 10 keys with a spread between my thumb and my pinky, so maybe I have big hands.
Sean, and nothing against your hands, but you're not the tallest person here?
No, I'm not.
And
I'm not.
I'm assuming that I have bigger hands than you because I have relatively large hands. I wear an extra large glove, and even that, I think I need to step up to a double X on some brands. Not that that's really relevant.
Right. But no, I don't know. So, I mean, I've never had a problem with them, and I haven't used a great deal of other drills and drivers.
It could just be what you're used to.
It could be. And there's difference in them. I mean, I'm from where I'm sitting, I can see the soft bag that has the old 12 volt with the non-cylindrical battery that just like sticks right up in the bottom end of it as a clip. Those are a different shape than what my 18 volt Brute has, and that thing's dying. The battery can't hold the charge anymore or anything. But I don't know. They're all a little different, but I've not had a problem with them. But I haven't used another maker's. You know, my dad's got Milwaukee stuff, but I can't remember the last time I put one in my hand. I just don't. But back in the day, like I was building houses with gas pass load nailers. Those things had terrible handles.
Yes,
but
they did.
Not like they was uncomfortable. They were just shit.
But that was a pass load.
Yeah, maybe that was. But again,
they had gas charges in the handle, or was it a battery in the handle? Gas charges in front. I don't remember.
How was it? No, it was just gas charge. It was gas charge, but it was in the handle. I'm trying to remember how we did that. Because you had to push them in, and then when they were done, you would throw them in the fire and make them explode. I remember it distinctly.
You know, when you come for Fine Woodworking Live in 2021, yeah. I have a fire pit in the backyard. You should bring your old cartridges.
Yeah, I don't. Those are the construction company I work for. They were theirs, but it's anyway. Yeah, I guess handle geometry has never really bugged me. You know, and if I look at the different saws and stuff I have, like hand saws, those handles are completely off the boards. You know, my one rip saw is square in one profile, and so you're wrapping around to a thinner section than you're holding between the pad of your hand and your fingers. It's just, I don't know. I've never had a problem, but maybe that's just me.
Maybe.
Let me bring us all the way back to the Milwaukee M12 Fuel 3/8-inch installation drill driver.
Yes. It just rolls off the tongue.
It does. Well, Festool CXS is, I guess, a little bit better, but it sounds like a train.
Do they have like a 1/8 or a quarter inch installation driver?
It's a quarter inch
or a half inch installation driver.
It's a quarter inch quick release, but I think it's because it's a 3/8 inch drill when you put the chuck on it, which are just traditionally a little smaller than the half inch drill.
Yeah.
So that chuck has a capacity to.
Yeah, the chuck has a 3/8 inch, but the chuck is just one of four tips that plug into it. So I don't know why it's that size. Why don't they just call it their little baby drill driver? I don't know.
Yeah.
But I don't know. To get back to ergonomics for a second, it's not necessarily a problem, but to hold it properly and to use it, it's a very pistol grip style cordless tool. Like a lot of drill drivers are like a T handle, and this is a pistol grip, and you need to pull the trigger with your middle finger and have your index finger like running along the side of the body to grip it comfortably. And
okay.
I don't actually mind that. Like, that's how I hold a saw. Like, I'm holding my Veritas, I don't know, one of my Veritas saws, my 14 TPI crosscut saw in my hand as we're talking. And that's exactly how I just naturally put my finger. But that's a saw, and I don't naturally hold a drill that way. So it's not a complaint, but it's just I've had to get used to holding it that way. And when you hold it that way, it's wonderful because your finger's right in line with the driver, and it works fine. It's just different than every other driver I have.
Yeah, that's different. Well, the lightweight and some torque, maybe that helps with just controlling it. To have a higher hand, to have your middle finger engaging the trigger. I mean, there's just a whole lot of weird ergonomic movement.
Yeah, that's interesting because my Milwaukee, the 12 volt, which is a hammer driver. It's a big one, but it's before they made 18 volts. It's probably, you know, 4 or 5 years old, but it's more of a pistol grip style. And I'm gonna have to pay attention the way I actually hold that one versus my other Milwaukee, which is a newer one. And it's more of a, that T type handle,
it's a hammer drill. So is that one of the ones that has the battery that kind of mounts in the front, in front of the handle?
No. It mounts in the handle. Both of them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, both of them are "quote unquote" hammer drill drivers, but are hammer drills. But like, one's a 12 volt, one's 18 volt. I mean, they're full size. You know, they're not baby. They're not like this drill driver type stuff. They're standard format.
Right.
Yeah.
And but, I'll just throw this out there for anybody who actually.
Yeah, I'm just wondering with the pistol grip on the 12 volt. I wonder how I actually hold that because I'm kind of second nature to use my middle finger and put my index finger along the body of it. How do I actually use it when I grab it?
Yeah.
A lot of that.
I'm going to pay more attention because I flopped recently between three different drills of two different formats. And, you know, two of them use the same battery, but they're different ones. One's got a full chuck on the front and one just got the spring loaded.
The 8-inch quick release.
Quick release. Yeah. And then the other is the pistol grip one. And I think I'm between middle and index finger, you know, pulling, you know, depending. I don't know. I'm going to have to.
Yeah.
I'll just pay more attention to that. I maybe it's just an interchangeable movement. Maybe.
Well, let's give Festool a little love, though.
Well, I do love Festool on so many things, but I think. I don't know. It sounds like I'm the one. I know people who universally love them or universally hate them.
Yeah.
And I don't know anyone else who takes the 50-50 view that I have. Like, I'm staring right now. I literally, let me count. I have 11 Festool Sanders hanging in my Sander cart, and I probably have one or two more besides that.
Yes.
I have both dominoes. I have the track saw. I have dumped my kids' college education into Festool tools. So
yes,
I'm not against
you have
Festool.
Right to complain.
But they are not universally the best at everything. There are some things that they suck at. Their routers are garbage. Their cordless drills are way overpriced, and some of them are okay, some of them are terrible. Like they're jigsaws. I don't get it. Their jigsaws suck. Like they're no tool company makes everything the best. That's true of everybody. Years and years and years ago, I was a huge fan of Porta-Cable before they got bought by DeWalt. Porta-Cable used to make the best corded screw guns. I don't know that that category doesn't even exist anymore, but there was a time when they made the absolute best corded screw guns. But they didn't make the best of other things. So I think you need to approach Festool like every other company. They're not this, you know, holier than thou, you know, wonderful, brilliant company. They make some very nice stuff and some of the stuff that's okay.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And one of the things I think they do make nice is their dust extractors.
That they do. I have two of them. They're wonderful.
Yes. And they can be a little pricey, but
oh my God.
But they just released a new one.
Okay. I don't know that because I've not been paying attention.
Yes.
But let me ask you. The lead-in makes it sound like it's affordable. Does that mean it's too small to use?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think it's a standard. It's not, you know, I have the 36, an old one before they redesigned them. But that's been a workhorse for me. But they just came out with a CT15, which
Boy,
I think
is baby.
They had their MIDI size, the mini one and a MIDI one. I think it's like the MIDI size one. So it's bigger than their mini one. But I mean, it's a fully, cart one. It looks to be, I don't know. I want to say it stands maybe 24 inches tall, something in that neighborhood. Anyway, it's only $349.
Did you say only?
That is a great price for Festool dust extractors.
And you know, at that price, it's kind of a gateway drug. So
yes.
I don't knock it. And what I will say is a couple things about Festool dust extractors, not necessarily even that one. You talk about how you have the old one.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one where the dust intake is on the side, not the center.
No, it's in the center, but I want to say mine's like from around 2007, 2008. I think around 12 or so, they redesigned them.
Yours must have. You must have the dust. Either it's newer or the dust extractor is on the side. The actual hose fitting is on the side. Because it was probably only about 4 or 5 years ago that they redesigned them to move the dust connection to the center.
You're talking about mine's on the front. Are you talking about the side of the dust collector or the
No,
side
no,
of
it's
the
front, but the older ones had it all the way. If you're facing the dust collector, it's all the way in the left versus centered on the front.
I thought you meant on the side.
No.
You're exactly right.
Okay.
That's the model I have.
Yours is better. I don't have my numbers in front of me, and from where I'm sitting, I can't actually see it. It's behind my sander rack. Is the 26 is the big one? The 36? What's the number for the big one?
I think 36. I think mine was the biggest at the time. I think it's like a 32.
Exactly. Yeah. So I have the older style in the biggest size at the time, and I have the newer style in the biggest size at the time. My older style is wonderful. I actually burnt out the HEPA filters because I was intaking burning MDF embers and it melted the filters. I'd have replaced the filters.
Oh.
But it's been an absolute workhorse, and I have a dust deputy on it, and it's wonderful. It is a great, great vacuum. I have the newer one. The older one is a little awkward to lock in that there's a separate lock for each of the rear wheels. And at least in my driveway, which is not level, some of the times the rear wheels don't contact and it will still drift occasionally, but it's not bad.
Mm-hmm.
The newer one, it doesn't lock with the wheels. It has this little foot that comes out in the middle, which makes it a tripod, and it's a little tippy, and I don't like that. The new one is a little harder to open. I'm forgetting the inside because, quite frankly, I got the new one. I said, this is not an improvement. I put the new one in the attic, and I haven't used it since. I talked to my Festool dealer, and I was told at the time the new one came out, which has to be, correct me if I'm wrong, 2-3 years ago? Maybe 3-4 years ago? It's a while.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, it's been a while. Yeah.
When the new one came out, which of course takes different bags, I was told that they would only make bags for the old one for 5 years. So I didn't just turn around and sell the new one because I didn't want to be in a situation where 5 years down the road, I couldn't get bags for my old one and I needed a new one.
Mm-hmm.
So my new one has been sitting up in my attic virtually since I got it. And I continue to use the old one, which there's some subtle things that they say are better about the new one. I don't even remember what they are at this point, but none of them proved to be any better. The old one, the wheels lock easier. The form factor is a little bit smaller, more compact. It made it easier to fit in my shop. And I still have 3 bags for the old one. So until I run out of bags and can't get them anymore, I will continue to use the old one. And then I'll reluctantly switch to the new one.
Yeah, and
they're
good
dust collectors. They're awesome.
Yeah, they're awesome. And this is, like you said, an entryway, gateway drug, so to speak, into the Festool ecosystem. But, I mean, this one's $350. It comes with an anti-static hose, which the other ones do not. They come with the regular green hose. This one has the gray hose. And it even comes with a couple of tools, a crevice tool and a sweep tool, which is pretty nice. Mine didn't come with any accessories like that. And like I said, it's only $350. Their mini, which is smaller than this one, I think is $500.
Now, wow. That's interesting. So this is kind of like the one and only Festool I have, which is the CT125. No, it's not CT, but whatever. The sander that's brought up a couple years ago.
The one that was $100.
It was $100. Yeah. So I got into Festool for $100. Suck it. but I do want to call attention to this highlighted line on their site that said the CT5 does not have Bluetooth connectivity and there is no option for Bluetooth as an add-on. Please tell me why in God's name you need Bluetooth technology on a dust collector. I know the answer. It's stupid.
You're correct. I don't remember. I try to listen to most of the woodworking podcasts out there. And you have to forgive me. I don't remember which podcast it was, but literally 2 days ago, a day ago, it wasn't today because I was in the office all day, but last time I was in the car for an extended period of time, which I think was yesterday, I was listening to one of the many woodworking podcasts out there. And there was a discussion of one of the hosts had multiple CT vacuums and was talking about how he had a couple, but the one that he really liked was the one with the Bluetooth. And at the time, my thought was, why the hell do you need a Bluetooth connector on your vacuum? Like, you go to the Festool website, and it talks about how, you know, if you have the Bluetooth in the vacuum, your kids won't get cancer, and you can't get the coronavirus.
Jesus Christ. I know.
But it touts some mythical benefit, and I think I use the vacuum as rigorously, perhaps less frequently, but as rigorously as anybody out there. And I remember when they came out with it thinking, why on earth would I want to do that? And now that I'm sitting here, I can't think of a reason why Bluetooth is important. Like, the advantage of the vacuum is that you plug your tool into it. And when the tool turns on, the vacuum turns on. And when the tool turns off, it turns off 15 seconds later. So it clears the lines of dust. And beyond the fact that it's a really good vacuum, that is a wonderful feature that, frankly, all vacuums should do, but only a handful of them do.
Yes. So something I put on my whole house humidifier is a current sensing relay.
Yes.
So that it only blows wet air when the fan is actually blowing. Otherwise, it's going to put wetness into a system that's not moving air, and that's a bad thing.
Exactly.
So why that needs to be wirelessly, any wireless technology, why? It doesn't make sense, because you're only going to plug one thing into this thing at a time.
But, okay, here's the thing, and I think in this discussion, I think I've come up with it, is for the newer generation of cordless tools. Because if you're cordless, it can't sense when the tool is on or off.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, and I could have this wrong. I should be looking it up, but I'm not. So if I have this completely wrong, I apologize.
That does make sense.
But here's the thing. I was listening. I've shared this a couple times tonight. I will continue to share it. I'm 2 weeks behind on my podcasts. Everyone take note. I was listening to the most recent, for me, Fine Home Building podcast, because I think most of us would enjoy that. And Patrick's a nice guy. I like him. Mm-hmm. And in their most recent episode that I've listened to, which is probably 2 weeks old, they were discussing track saws. And they're not woodworking guys. They're carpenters. And Patrick is the host of the show. I know him personally. When you talk about eighth of an inch accuracy, his eyes glaze over. He is a carpenter, not a woodworker. And that's mm-hmm. wonderful, because he makes nice stuff. And he's a good guy, and I like him. But he was talking about having the Festool track saw. And another editor was talking about having a cordless track saw and the advantage of the cordless. And they were both like, well, it'd be really nice if I connected to the vacuum, but I don't bother connecting it to the vacuum. And I'm yelling at the car because I'm listening to this as I'm driving. And I sent them an email, because of course I did, about how they were right. You need to connect the track saw to the vacuum. But the instant you connect it to the vacuum, the fact that it's cordless is useless, because you've already got a vacuum hose. Why not have a regular cord? So
right.
That returns to this vacuum discussion of, if I'm going to connect the vacuum to a sander or a saw or a domino, why on earth would I need it to be cordless? Because I've already got a vacuum hose going to it.
Because some might, and that's why. I mean,
that's why they're wrong. They're just wrong. Like, it's a waste of money.
Right. No, and I heard that actually from a post framer, because I'm interested in that kind of stuff, that... like he was, whatever, he was working back in his shop instead of on the field. And he said, yeah, because of all the battery stuff, we've been using battery nailers and battery drivers, you know, but man in the shop, this air hose connected nailer really is awesome. It's lightweight. Yeah. It's easy to move around. Mm-hmm. Why would you not? You know, there's a place for it and there's a place not for it. You know, the advantages are, there are separations between the two. Just why.
In that application, I agree. But again, I'm going to come back to the fact that for a Bluetooth-connected vacuum to work, the vacuum hose needs to be connected to the tool.
Yeah, so why are you using
exactly? Even tool? If you're absolutely. In the field, cordless tools are wonderful. But the minute you connect them to a vacuum and the vacuum has to plug in, why wouldn't you just use a cordless tool that plugs into the vacuum? Because you already have a hose going there.
Yep.
Ah, not so fast. They do have some cordless vacuums now.
Not Festool.
I don't think Festool does. I don't know. What about their itty bitty one, that little sustainer size one? I don't know if that. Oh,
you know what? That one might. I don't think so, but it might. But honestly, yeah. I look at that one, and unless you're installing, you know, jewelry boxes in $1 million homes, why would you ever want a vacuum that small? It's kind of cool that it fits in with everything else. But it's so friggin' tiny. Oh, my God.
But anyway, if you're interested in Festool dust extractors,
check them out.
So that's how I feel.
Check out the CT15 for only $349.
Yeah. Or you can get yourself an M-Fuel 3/8 installation drill driver.
Yes, yes. But okay, well, let's talk about Festool some more, because you know, yes. They're always giving us some things. So they have a new mobile sawing table is what they're calling it out. And I watched the videos of it. It's kind of interesting, but I think you could build something very similar yourself for less than $1,000.
For the listeners who heard me made that noise, I apologize that I'm looking at these things for the first time as we're recording. and I am not a proper host and haven't prepared and haven't looked at these notes. I own that. It's sitting in front of my garage right now, but it's made by a different company, and I only paid half the price for it.
The unique thing about this that I saw that was interesting is, you know, it will help you handle your sheet goods and actually put them up into a horizontal orientation,
so from a vertical to a horizontal panel saw orientation. Yeah,
exactly. And it also, you know, you can also, you know, disassemble it fairly easily and get it into a nice compact shape. And I think it'll handle some large goods, but $1,000 is a lot to spend on something like that.
It's too much.
Yeah. I'm thinking, you know, with some experience I've had with, are y'all guys familiar with 8020? They make extruded aluminum parts you can buy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You can make something using their components for probably a third of the price, I would think.
Well, I have.
Yeah.
When I'm actually doing work, which has not been for a very long time, yeah. I apologize to the listener. When I'm actually doing work, I use my benchmark table all the time, and I often get questions about it. It's a collapsible aluminum table that has plastic, not wooden things that pop up on the top, and you can saw through the plastic. And before they went into business, they were nice enough to send me a bunch of stuff, so I have extra plastic tops. Yes. And it's an imperfect solution because they are out of business.
Right.
But I think I paid about $400 for it. Mm-hmm. And mine, this Festool thing kind of folds up like an accordion. Like the cross pieces have hinges, and it remains standing, and it had wheels on the bottom, which is kind of cool, I guess.
Yeah.
But it kind of all folds up, so it's still the same height, but compacted. Mm-hmm. Whereas mine, the legs hinge underneath it, so I have to flip mine onto its side, and the legs fold up. So mine's about 30 inches wide by about 5 foot long, something like that. You put it supports a sheet good just fine, but the sheet good hangs over on the sides.
Yeah.
And I love it. I absolutely love it. And I've had mine for years and years, probably going on a decade. And I would not be without it when it finally dies, because I'm going to be upset that I can't buy another one. It's a great, great thing. And if this is your version of that, you know what? I've gotten $1,000 worth of use out of mine, and mine was only $400. But was $400. Like, why would you pay $1,000 for this? Yeah. Like, I just don't get it.
Yeah, I don't either. Well, I guess if you're in the, you know, if you're an on-site contractor and you're in the Festool world and you want to, you know,
okay, but
and
you know
you're
what?
Doing that all the time, you may be able to pay for something like this in short order. I don't know.
Two things. If you're an on-site contractor, $1,000 is in the cost of the job. It's not that big a deal. I absolutely understand that. And all things being equal, their market is professionals who make money at this. So in that world, $1,000 is not that much money. I absolutely understand that. But your second point of you're in the Festool world, all this is a table. It doesn't interact with their system at all. Like, you get a table from anybody. This is a rather unique, special table, but it's not like it connects to your vacuum or your sander or something. It's just a table.
No, it has Bluetooth.
Oh, dear God.
So you get a notification when you fold it up, your phone knows?
Exactly, you know, and you can locate it around the job site, you know?
Nope. It's a big nope.
Yeah, there's probably a market for this. Clearly, they think there is a market for this, and they're probably right. But I'm going to go with you, Sean. Nope.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I put it in the show notes, because I knew Diami, you'd have a fun time with this one.
And for anyone who wants to look it up, it is the Festool 205183 STM 1800 mobile sawing table.
Ooh, I wanted the 2800.
It rolls off the tongue. Another one.
Yeah, you got to wait till they upgrade it, and then the bags won't fit anymore.
Right. Anyway, so I got something for you, which is a little smaller, a little more fits in your pocket kind of thing.
This is what they emailed out today, right?
No, this was earlier this week, maybe.
Yeah,
there was another thing today.
Yeah,
but it was earlier this week. The Woodpecker's Pocket Compass. Now, I don't find myself needing to draw circles on the fly, but the in the woodpecker style of red anodized aluminum precision machined parts, this is a pretty slick like a little thing where it's got basically how would you say that? They slide inside each other. Two pieces that slide inside each other. That,
it's like a male and female component with adjustability.
There you go. Right. That you set a point. It has a point that threads into the back end of it for storage, and then can be put into it for as a pivot point. And a pencil drives down in it, and you can draw circles of varying diameters, and there's two different sizes, so you can I thought there was a cool little thing in the same vein as the Paulini pocket square that they brought out years ago. It appears to be about the same size, and
the small one
at least. Because do you have the big one of those, the Paulini ones?
I have two of the small ones, actually. I don't have the big one.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I didn't realize they made a big Paulini, but this.
I thought they got like
they make a big
one
and a small one.
Yeah. But yeah, so the small one of these for sure, it's like, it is truly pocketable. And it just, if you find the need to draw, now these are true circles. There's no ellipsoid or any other shapes you can do with them. They are just, it's a circle cutter or circle marker and only a circle marker. But, I think that's pretty cool.
You know, I'm going to second that and harp on it for a minute. Is that
go?
If you're in the market or in the habit of making circles often, this is probably a really good way to go. Because I will admit that when I have made circles, it's been kind of some kind of jury-rigged thing that kind of makes a circle. No, it makes a circle, but it's not that stable, and I have to babysit it, and it's not ideal. And I actually have a they sponsor the other podcast, but I have a Rockler circle cutting jig that I bought after the last circle I made. Because I figured I might make more circles, but I haven't made a circle since. So if you were making circles, I'm sure this is fantastic, because Woodpeckers makes really nice stuff, and it's well machined, and it looks very convenient in that sense. I make not necessarily square stuff, but I tend to power carve more than make circles. So the Paolini rule that you mentioned, one lives in my apron. Like, it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. But it was, I'm going to guess it was $50, something like that.
I don't even know. Because I have one too. I don't think it was that much.
It wasn't. 35? It wasn't terribly expensive.
Yeah, I have one. I don't think it was that much either.
This is $100 or $150, depending on the size. I'm looking at the website
there's
now.
60. You can do the one to seven inch range. Right. The little one is $60. So the big one is $100.
The 60 is probably only a little bit more than the Paolini rule was at the time. Maybe it's $20 more.
Yeah,
maybe.
Which I guess is 30%, but still, if you're making circles often, I am sure this is a wonderful tool. I don't make circles often. It seems a wonderful tool to solve a problem I don't have.
I actually make circles fairly often. But the thing I can see that's great about this is it's easy to set it up. Say, I want a 2-inch circle. Looks like you can easily get it to 2 inches and boom. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're using, what I use, a traditional compass, is that, you may have to lay that up against a ruler, adjust it, and then do a fine adjustment to get into your, dimensions. But I'd be interested to play around with one, but even though I make circles, I'm not sure I want to spend $60 or $100. I got a nice compass that works really well.
Well, the question is,
I think it was about $40 or so.
It's a twofold question. How many circles do you make, and do you get paid for those circles?
Exactly.
Because that's the answer to this thing.
Yeah, exactly. But, I can see some advantages. It's something you can carry around with you, where a compass can, especially the one I have, is a fairly big one and, has sharp points and all kinds of neat stuff like that you don't want to be sliding into your apron in and out. So I can definitely see where this would come in handy, because it looks like the little piece that actually, that you revolve around, the little pinprick, as I would say, actually installs inside the device, so you don't have to worry about any sharp points or anything like that, or having to find a cap to cover your sharp point.
Right. So as a thing, it's nicely self-contained, and I mean, it's one of their rolling one-time tools. They just like to set up machining for one thing, find out how many people want it, and then make that many. You know, and then they can change the machining. That's basically how they operate.
All things equal, that's a wonderful method because it brings a lot of things to market that might not be able to. And I don't fault them for it at all because it lets them gauge things. And understanding how they make them with the machining and the level of waste they have in aluminum that, believe it or not, doesn't end up square when they're done machining it because it has some memory. While I complain about the expense of certain things that are so specialized that I'll never use, I will never complain about the costs relative to what they invest in making these things. Like, it's a lot of work to make them.
Right. No, for sure. So, yeah, I mean, it's a very, you know, special need, maybe specific need tool, but I thought it was kind of interesting. Like you said, it's self-contained. It's not going to poke it through your pockets or anything like that. And, I mean, even the big one probably fits in an apron. It's 7 inches long, give or take. So, I mean, it's not gigantic.
Would it be fair to call it the Paolini pocket rule of circle jigs?
Yes, not knowing Mr. Paolini and whether or not he would agree to that. But, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry. I do not have the Paolini one. I have the DV one.
You're off Delvey, the podcast.
Delvey.
I'm not even talking to you. If you can see me, I'm holding up my hand. You're done.
But I was just curious how much it was. The one I bought was $50.
That's probably about what we paid. The Paolini pocket rules were not expensive. I have two only because I bought one for my dad for Father's Day, and he bought himself one before I could give it to him, so I kept both.
There you go. Yeah, no, but yeah, Kyle, you're off purely because of the lack of red anodized aluminum in your shop.
Damn it! I do have their angle gauge.
Mm-hmm. I bet you do.
Yeah. You know what? All my woodpecker stuff, it matches my Milwaukee stuff.
The red one. Yeah. Got it.
And your Bessie clamps, right?
That's right. And as I look at it, I guess it is just the Bessie. The jets are red too. And yes. The plastic cups I use for mixing things in, they're red too.
Oh, really? Oh, you know what?
They're solo cups.
So another thing to add in that actually was mentioned, and I'll ride right off of the Wood Talk episode that I most recently listened to, way before this episode comes out. Another thing, what was it? It was the glue. It's a woodpecker's, no, it's a Rockler glue.
Glue brush?
No, like it's a container. It's a square container, square-ish container.
Holds
like 4 to 6 ounces of glue.
Who would steal your glue in a square container?
Well, it's silicone, so it releases no matter what.
And it has a little for like projects when you're gluing up. Yeah, someplace to put your glue.
Yeah, they're wonderful.
Yeah, I that's the first I'd heard of it, and I looked it up, and I'm like, oh, that is really cool, because I'm mixing epoxy, doing this rocket stuff I've been doing, in like wax cups, like just like bathroom cups that for some reason we have them down here. They're not Dixie cups, they're whatever, but they're fine, and the epoxy actually releases from them. It's probably something bad that I'm mixing them in a wax-lined paper cup, but...
Yeah.
I don't know.
By the way, I just noticed here before we get off this subject too far is the pocket compass. Mm-hmm. They had the small one back in 2013.
Oh, they did.
For $50.
Okay.
So
they didn't have a large one. What does it go for now?
60.
Yeah. 2013?
Yeah, $50, 2013.
I don't think that's...
No, inflation. It happens.
The new ones come with the virus, so... No, they don't. That's
not fair to say. Hold on. The small one went up to 7 inches in diameter, right?
Yes.
Yes. This one back in 2013, only 6.5.
Oh.
So they've expanded more material, $10 more.
Yep.
7 years later, it's well within. Yeah.
Yep.
Sound marketing. We're good.
So anyway. So what were you talking about? Oh, yeah, the little Rockler glue pot thing.
Yeah, the glue pot thing. That interesting. You know, it as a non-disposable way of a mixing small batches of epoxy if you're doing little craft epoxy, or even project glue where you're not. And I've never. Have you guys ever like poured out glue, used it, and then tried to pour it back in?
Mm-hmm.
I tend not to pour it out. The epoxy,
okay. I've never done that, yeah.
Because it cures. But yeah. Most glue, I pour right out of the bottle onto it. This is the Rockler Silicone Glue Keeper, this square thing.
Yes.
Yep. I just looked it up. It's $10. It's like,
yeah, it's super cheap. It's basic. They, you know, the guys on Wood Talk talked about seeing it at Workbench Con.
Yeah.
And it for $10, I mean, that's cheaper than even the cheapest cups.
Well,
mixing cups.
What's interesting is I do use their glue brushes.
Yeah, I have a couple myself.
And both the large ones and the small ones. And they just came out with some even smaller ones, and I picked those up. And I noticed here in the pictures, they rest neatly
on
top of the container. So that's nice.
There you go. That's a thing.
I've had sometimes with silicone, because I got some silicone pads, is the glue does release from it, but it doesn't always all release from it. You kind of have to wash it.
I'm only using Tight Bond. As I look at my shelf, I have Tight Bond 1, 2, and 3. Mm-hmm. But I'm only using Tight Bond in my silicone stuff, and I have no problem just peeling it off once it dries.
Okay.
I
don't have to wash it. Well, maybe me, because I'm using primarily liquid hide glue. So
you see, it's not as clean as you think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can just heat it up. It'll just
probably. Yeah, you're probably not wrong.
You can rework it.
Yeah, probably melt the glue pot.
Maybe.
Or the container. Something to
be careful.
Keeper.
Yes. But for $10, I'm considering it.
Could I ask a question? And I don't mean to be the spoil sport here.
Please.
Maybe I do mean to be the spoil sport here.
Yeah.
What's the shipping?
Oh, I don't know.
Because that is the issue with Rockler. Their products are not prohibitively expensive. They're usually a good deal. But their shipping. We live in a world where shipping costs are minimal because of monster corporations, and they're not a monster corporation, and I'm trying to be sympathetic to that, but their shipping seems prohibitively expensive.
Well, see, I have to drive by one every time I go into Houston, so it's not a big deal.
The nearest one to me, I think, is in Ohio.
Oh.
Yeah. And the nearest one to me is 2.5 hours away from me in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
It's better than 10.
Yeah. Okay.
Hold on.
Add to cart. View proceed.
It's probably one of those things where they have free shipping for like purchases up to $40, and you're at $32. You can just throw this on there.
I think there's an Amazon way of doing this. As Amazon Pay is an option at checkout. I'll bet you you can get them right on Amazon.
I know Woodcraft.
Woodcraft has their stuff.
But their shipping is just as expensive through Amazon as it is.
Yeah.
Now there is a Woodcraft a mile away from my office, so I could definitely do that.
The nearest Woodcraft to me is in Rochester, which is about 9 hours away.
Oh my God.
Man, you would think somewhere near you there would be both a Woodcraft and Rockler.
There's Tools for Working Wood, which is only 1.5 hours in Brooklyn.
Oh, that's true.
Oh, that's 1.5 hours away.
Well, it depends on the time of day, but
Yeah.
Tom, after Tom got moved up to New York to help with Katrina, which for those of you who remember, Katrina happened to us in the fall, and Woodworking America, Katrina hit us on a Sunday into Monday, and Woodworking America started that Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
So I managed to go to Woodworking America. I shared a room with Tom that year. He had his bag packed to go to New York, but ended up flying back to Tampa before then, like 2 days later, turning around and flying into New York to help with Katrina. So,
is that the one in Winston-Salem?
No, because I didn't go to Winston-Salem. We were in Kentucky, in Covington.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I mentioned it is Tom was, he was helping in some department that he wasn't qualified for. Tom's a wonderful guy. He was qualified in public relations very well. He wasn't in public relations. He was in, like, logistics. I forget what it was, but he was complaining, rightfully so, about, you know, the fact that they took all this team from Florida that was experienced in handling hurricanes and completely mismanaged them and sent them to departments they had no experience in. But anyway, he was working like 14 and 16 hour days for most of the 2 weeks he was in New York. So it's like day 14, it's day 10 out of 14, something like that. And he only worked a 12-hour day. So I drove into Brooklyn to pick him up, and we hung out in the afternoon. And we tried to go to Tools for Working Wood, and we got there like 5 minutes after they closed, and we didn't get to go. That was the point of this whole story. So I'm sorry I've ranted about Hurricane Katrina, but I've been there myself a couple times, Katrina, but I was trying to take Tom.
That was Tropical Storm Sandy, though. That wasn't...
You're absolutely Katrina. Right.
Katrina hit New Orleans.
Yeah. But it rolls off the tongue so much better than Sandy.
Maybe.
No, you're absolutely right. I'm embarrassed to say that, to realize that. Jeez.
Yeah, well, I was like, what?
You know, I think we might be done. I might be done.
Stick a fork in it.
Yeah. So, yes, Sandy hit New York and Katrina hit South, specifically New Orleans. So I'm done. I'm sorry. I'm gonna step back now.
It was a good story, nonetheless.
It was good. It was good.
I assure you, all the facts were true except for the name of the storm.
Except for the name of the storm. Yep.
Yeah. All right. Well, should we move on?
Yes.
To now that we've gone through what's piqued our interest. So what's in the shop, Sean?
I actually did a thing.
Oh, you did a thing.
I did a thing. It was the most menial, simple thing, and it was totally unexpected. But I did get to use woodworking tools, and I made dust and shavings in the process of remaking a rotten piece of trim. The piece I was replacing was rotten. I wasn't making the rotten piece. Anyway, I walk into work. Guy that I work with says, "Oh, hey. Here," and he hands me a pine board and a painted piece of trim. He said, "This was in my closet. It's rotten. You can make this, right?" I said,
"Sure."
I went, "Okay." So it was cut to width, and it was as tall as he wanted it. It was basically a 1x6 piece, but and it had a simple. I think it's called a. It's not even a village. Style, like just a really fair curve on the top edge of just return. So it was a simple curve anyway, but I had to thin it down, which I used a combination of crosscut and rip saw, but I got like my Moxon vise out. I got my Veritas saws out. I got my spoke shave out. I got a little hand plane out. I made a thing, and it's probably going to be painted and put inside a closet and never seen the light of day ever again.
Well, what thing did you make?
It was a piece of trim. I just made a piece of trim. Just like it literally was a rectangle that I made thinner and rounded one top corner.
Okay.
That's fantastic. And I think you even posted on
I did. Instagram. If you look at my Instagram, I posted me in the process of doing just that. As much as I can hold the tool and take a picture. Yes.
And we were all hoping it was rocket parts.
I know. I was like, what, rocket parts? No, sorry, no rocket parts. This was legitimate pine. To be painted at a later date, not in my house. But it was fun. I haven't used my spoke shave in years.
But I didn't realize you had a Moxon vise.
Me? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've got I got that old Benchcrafted thing when they brought that out. God, how many years ago was that? Oh, 10-ish years ago.
Wow.
And I've got big old 8-quarter ash slabs holding that vise together and... or using as the jaws of that vise. And I love that thing. It's great to do exactly what I did, which was like rip cutting something, because you can cut right down through it from the side. And I just put it up on my bench, like front, and hold I it guess down.
Because it's not tightening as you go. It doesn't bind on the kerf, does it?
No, it really doesn't. But the way I was doing it, the piece was small enough, and I was using... essentially dovetail saws, so they have barely 2 inches below the back of the saw, the spine of the saw. So I kind of treated a corner with a cross cut, then flipped the corner and treated the next corner with a cross cut, and then tried to connect those lines with the cross cut saw, but now that was a rip cut. So I brought the rip saw to connect those, and just the feeling of something like that, which is very small. I mean, this thing was like 6 inches long and 4 inches wide. It's a very small piece of wood that I'm working on. And so the cut, you know, it's, and it's a small saw that I'm using too, but the switch to a properly sharpened rip saw that you can tell it is a legitimate row of chisels just going right straight across. It was awesome. Like it just, I never worried about wavering off my line. It was just perfect.
Right, I heard you're just that dead accurate.
I might be that dead accurate. And so, yeah. And so to prove that point, I took a 3/4 inch board and made it 5/8 and had wood, I had a solid piece of wood that I cut off it. And I gave that back to my coworker and said, here, you don't need this, but I want to show you that I can do this. That's what I took off it.
Awesome. There you go.
That is awesome.
Have fun. There you go. So I used woodworking tools on wood.
I would argue you did woodworking.
I did woodworking.
Nah, it's more trim carpentry.
It is kind of trim carpentry. That's true. Is that because it wasn't putting any more than one piece together? It was just shaping one piece.
You were making big pieces of wood smaller.
And you should be on Wood Talk. I said, look, honey, I can. This is what I do. I make wood smaller.
Yeah.
She wasn't impressed. Anyway, Kyle, what's in your shop?
Let's see. I guess I released some new videos with my boring jig because I had the production model, which differed from the one I released videos for earlier. So I still got one more video to put out there. I'll probably either do that tonight or tomorrow. But
did you replace the old videos?
Yeah. I'm going to. Yeah. Once I get this last one up, I'm going to take some of the ones that I had up there down. So,
okay.
Yeah, because the ones before were with the quote unquote pre-production model. And then when I actually produced them, I incorporated a couple of design things that made it just a little bit easier to use. And the little angle gauge setup block that I came up with, I found some improvements on calibrating that to each individual boring jig, so that became more accurate. So my other videos were kind of obsolete, which makes sense, you know. And so I did those videos, and so I've been releasing them, I don't know, about every other day. So I have one last one to release, but it's, you know, and one of the things I did include in these videos is that you can now use the boring jig to ream holes. And I think I talked about that on the last episode, looking for a source for a reamer. So, and I think I said I did reach out to Lee Valley. Well, I heard back from them. And they're not taking any special orders, but I was also disappointed that they were really forthcoming with telling me, yeah, we don't make this ourselves. There's another company that makes it, but I couldn't get them to tell me who that company was.
That's their reamer?
Yeah, I'm sure it's a Chinese. He said it was overseas, so I'm sure it's a made somewhere over in China. And so I've been looking for local sources. I've quickly found out I do not need a machinist. I need someone that grinds, because this is something that needs to be ground. But I keep getting some roadblocks here and there about people, you know, once I tell them what I want, then it's like, no, I don't work with high carbon steel. So I need to find somebody that works with high carbon steel. So still some more folks I need to reach out to, but I'll eventually find a source for it. I do have one guy local that I think I might have some success with. But
is it just the kind of thing where users could provide their own reamer? Do you need to sell the reamer with it? Is it specific that it needs to fit properly? Or reamer I bought fit with the jig I bought?
Yeah. Well, the Lee Valley reamers at 12 degrees included angle. So each side is 6 degrees of the cone, let's say. So most, you know, there are a lot of chair makers that utilize that reamer. There are some chair makers that utilize 11 degrees. And
is that just to be ornery?
Well, it's something that Mike Dunbar, you know, the Windsor Institute that really started teaching Windsor chairs, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago.
He's from New England. He is ornery.
Yes, and he started with the 11 degree reamer, but then most chair makers I know, like your Peter Galbraith, Curtis Buchanan, Elia Bazzari, and they all use 6 degree reamers, so 3 degrees on each side. And most of the people I know use the 6 degree reamers, and those are the ones that you can buy from Elia and Tim Manny. You know, they're the wooden hand reamers, and they're really nice. So, but to use this boring jig to ream holes, I really need a metal reamer that can be used in a drill. So that's the reason, and the reason for me having one built at the 6 degrees is because that's what everyone's used to. That's what everyone has. They probably maybe already have tenon cutters for their legs at 6 degrees. So, you know, you want to follow all that. Gotcha. So I just need to find a source. And I've had a lot of DMs from folks going, let me know as soon as you find a source, you know, because a lot of people are using these hand reamers, and they're made out of these wooden hand reamers. They're made out of various materials, maple and stuff, some hardwoods, but they can still be somewhat problematic when you're trying to ream a hardwood like a oak or something like that, rather than, you know, your standard pine or poplar.
The reamer head itself is still metal, right? It's just the handle we're talking about?
Mm-hmm. No, the whole machine, the whole reamer is wooden. But
oh, it just has the blade in
there. It has a blade in there. Okay. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so it's got a slot in the cone section with a blade in there.
Gotcha.
So, yeah. So, you know, I'm still looking at that. I got some folks I need to follow up with and reach out to. So I'm committed on finding one, but it's just not finding a source for it. But it's just not as quick as I thought it was going to be. So.
Godspeed.
Yep. I may have to be one of those guys that, you know, I may have to do this up in CAD. I'll probably send it over to you, Sean. Hey, does this look right?
I can do a thing. I mean, is this the Andy Klein way of, you know, doing it? It's like, yeah, nobody makes it, so I'm gonna make it myself, kind of thing.
Pretty much. So, you know, and I may have to reach out to some of these offshore sources and see if they can make me something, but we'll see how that goes. But on a brighter note, which I post about on Instagram, is my Sterrett combo square.
Yeah.
So I think I posted about, hey, I found out that my 12-inch Sterrett combo square was out of square. It wasn't square anymore. And I'd heard that, you know, you could file down the little tabs to bring it back in square, but I really didn't want to do that. And so I reached out to Sterrett, and the guy asked me, you know, common issues. Hey, make sure nothing's stuck in there, and, you know, all that stuff. And I said, yeah, nothing's stuck in there. It's never been dropped, you know, stuff like that. So it's like, well, send the head back to me. So I did. And within 3 days, I got the head back, perfectly fixed, ready to go. And at first, I thought they just replaced the head with a new one.
Mm-hmm.
But I finally looked in there and went, no, that's dirt that was probably there before. So I'm pretty sure this is my head. But they had definitely polished it up a little bit. So,
where
free of charge except for the shipping. Yeah,
where is Sterrett? Where did you send that?
Oh, you would ask me. It's a weird name. It's up northeast.
It's in the contiguous United States.
Boston.
Yeah.
Is it Boston?
No, probably not. He said northeast. That's where I went.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's see.
I'm just curious because a 3 day turnaround is pretty good because you presume it took a day to get there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, once they got it, it was.
Oh, okay. Amazing. But even so, that's pretty good.
So, I mean, what I'm saying is it didn't sit on the shelf or anything like that.
The L.S. So. Sterrett Company is headquartered in Althal, Massachusetts.
Yep.
Okay.
I knew it was a weird name.
That is a weird name.
Yeah.
So, never heard.
But yeah, for, I don't know, cost me six bucks or something to send it up there. But yeah, so. Big shout out to them for, you know, that's excellent customer service. And when they sent it back, this guy included a bunch of cool stickers as well as some like apron sized charts for taps and stuff. So
that's great.
I mean, what they are, as much as woodworkers love that company, that is a machinist's company.
Oh, yeah. It's a machinist. Yeah.
True and true.
Because it's from Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Sure.
No. It was like historically, when you think about like the last century, Massachusetts was the foundation of machinery and the machining in the country.
Oh, okay.
New England was, quite frankly, but Massachusetts, the heart of New England.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, and he did know whether I use it for metalworking or woodworking or whatnot. So
yeah.
That's great.
No, that's very
cool. So a big shout out to them. So that's great. So I need to buy some more stuff from them.
You've earned my business, sir. Thank
You've
you.
Earned my business. No, I do have too many things from them. But anyway, on another note, since I have been making these demo videos, I've had to make a number of seat blanks to drill out. I'm currently at 4 seat blanks that are fully drilled out. And so I need to turn these seat blanks into chairs. So I've been contemplating that, and I think it was Saturday on Instagram, Windsor Chairs by Dan posted out there that and he's a Windsor chair maker out of Maine, and he posted that he was selling spindles. And I fully roughed out, ready to, you know, do the fun part, which is, you know, turning them around and shaping them. So they're fully roughed out into octagonal shape. And I was like, how much you want for them? He goes, how much you need? I went, $35 a piece, free shipping.
Oh, my gosh.
I went sold. So for $150, I got spindles. They arrived yesterday, great condition, and it was great. So, you know, $35 a chair for spindles, can't beat that.
That sounds fantastic. But let me ask you, they're from Maine, a fantastic part of the country.
Right.
You're both very humid environs. Are they okay? Have they warped? Do they move?
No. You know, they're cut out on the grain, so none of them are going to be. There'll be a few that are dead straight, but there'll be a few that'll go in one direction or another. That's just part of the business, because they're cut along the grain, not necessarily to be straight, but to be even with the grain, parallel with the grain. So they came in fantastic condition, so ready to go. Yeah,
that's excellent.
So I need to reserve some time on the shave horse and get busy.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of building these chairs, I've been thinking about a new fixture for my bench, kind of like a poor man's high vice, I guess.
Really?
Yes. I've been thinking, for chair making, what I do when I'm saddling the seat, and I think I first saw Chris Schwartz do this, is take basically a 2x4 and screw it to the underside of your seat. And I do it between the two front leg holes, and then use that in a vise to secure the seat. And that works great. But I would like, you know, when you do that on a bench vise, especially your front vise, it's kind of hard to get around all 3 sides of the chair seat, so to speak. So what I'm thinking about doing is building a small auxiliary bench that will attach to the top of my current bench, and on the end of it have a quick release vise, which I happen to have just sitting around doing nothing, a small quick release vise. So I'm thinking about just putting something together, probably out of 2x4s, you know, just like you would a bench top, laminate some 2x4s on edge faced, you know, with the edge up, and I'll laminate enough of those to go across my one end of my bench, which, you know, my bench is in 2 different sections, and each section is about 11.5 inches wide. So for one of those sections, and then stick out enough to put that that vise on, and then I can use that to be able to secure the chair. It'll be a little higher, which will be a little bit more ergonomic, and I should be able to get around all sides of the seat, like, and I should be able to do, you know, secure the actual seat blank in the seats to carve the underside and of the seat and all the types of uses you would do for that. My only concern is if you're pulling too hard with the draw knife when you're trying to, like, put a chamfer on the underside of a seat, is that going to be too far out to kind of cantilever the bench? So that's the only concern I have right now. But
do you make enough seats, or once you have the jig making under control and you return to seats, do you make enough chairs that a full new higher bench is worthy, as opposed to a fixture that fits on your bench?
Well, Yeah, and I'm sure I was thinking about the fixture that fit on my bench would probably never be moved once it gets on there. But yeah, I have thought about doing an entire separate bench just for doing saddling seats. In fact, Curtis Buchanan has plans for that type of bench and out there. They're free, if memory serves correct, on his website. But I'm sort of running out of space in my shop for something like that. I know. I don't need another extra bench, so you know.
If I could fit one in mine, you could fit one in yours.
Yeah, I know. I know. I do like to walk around occasionally in my shop and pace back and forth, so that would cut into that space. But so I thought I'd just try this out and see how it works. It might be something I'll share out there if it does work, so that anyone that has, you know, one of those split top Rubos or those type of benches, it might work for them.
And I can appreciate that kind of fixture. Like, as we're doing this, I'm looking longingly at my carving bench, which has a pattern maker's vise attached to the front of it. And it's the tall, small bench, like the dovetail bench that Shannon made years and years ago.
Yeah.
And I think I probably got about 3 months of use out of it before it got buried behind this entertainment center that it's still hidden behind. And it was just such a joy to use for carving.
Right.
It's so... Yes, you should not make a bench fixture, though there's probably marketable. You're right there. But for your own use, make a standalone taller bench. You'll fit it in somewhere. You'll love it.
Yeah. I'll probably end up there. But I was just noodling and thought, let me try this out. No, this is nothing I would sell or sell plans for. It might be something I just share out there and go, hey, here's what I did. And see if it works. So... But with that, Diami, what's in your shop?
Well, you know what's in my shop? Listeners will find this hard to believe, but I have a Milwaukee M12 Fuel 3/8 inch installation drill driver in my shop.
What? Really?
I know.
How does that compare to the Festool drill
Surprisingly,
driver?
Surprisingly, it's better, but still not worth buying.
Hold on. No, let me go get mine. You keep talking. I'm going to go get my my Bosch drills and we can compare sound.
Okay.
Be right back.
I am, as we shared before, I'm not going to rehash it, but I am, you know, mediocrely impressed by it. But I will admit that for the last hour, it's been fun to play with in my hands while we're talking. And for anyone who checks out the Modern Woodworks Association story, you can see how the grip works and the offset head. But that's, unfortunately, that's about all that's been going on in my shop. I used it to fix some flagpole stands recently, and that's the extent of my recent woodworking. But that all being said, Kyle, I believe in your shop or perhaps in the kitchen above your shop, you have some Texas spring water.
Yes, I do. I do. That's my beverage of choice today, a little Texas spring water. So we have an event to go to tomorrow, so... I didn't really want to load up on anything, but we're still like 50-50 or whether we're going to go to this event. So,
is it an event that takes blood?
Well, it's kind of a little it's a little St. Patrick's Day get together that was planned, and we're still debating whether we're going to go or not.
So pacing yourself.
But I decided if we do decide to go, then, you know, I figured I'd just, you know, do my drinking tomorrow.
Fair enough. I hope you were able to enjoy yourself pandemic free.
Yes. That is funny is, you know, I was thinking about this the other day is with the pandemic, you know, woodworkers are readily prepared for this. We do. Most of us have the respirator with the P100 filters and gloves and, you know, Turner's got the full face mask. So.
Anyway, I was thinking about
if I do go tomorrow showing up wearing the respirator and gloves.
Sure. The respirator, at least. Yes. I'm not breathing your crap air.
Right? That's right. No.
We're as podcasters, we are also uniquely outfitted to not be in close contact with each other as we have this conversation.
Yes.
So we are free of transferring anything we may be carrying.
I don't know. Exactly. I have a pretty fancy mic. It might transmit.
I think I have the same mic.
I don't think you do. I have an ATR 2100.
I've got an ATR
something.
Yeah, I know we both have ATR Audio Technica.
I believe Sean has a different model.
Yeah. Mine's easily a higher number than yours.
It must be better then.
It must be. What the hell is it? I don't remember.
Anyway.
Yes, but I have a Rodecaster Pro.
Yeah, I don't.
Yeah. Well, since you don't have a Rodecaster Pro, Sean, do you at least have a beer to drink?
I do. So this was a little bit of a looking forward to getting the hell out of town for spring break next week. Hopefully, should the world not close down in the next 8 days.
Where are you going?
Down to Florida.
Oh, where in Florida?
Outside of Fort Myers.
Okay, because Cigar City is from Tampa, and I was going to say, if you're actually going to Tampa, you need to give Tom a hug and contaminate him.
No, but I do have rough plans right now to go to Tampa in November.
Oh.
So I may look up Tom at that point, although I'm going with my wife and friends without kids, and so alone time might be more...
Believe it or not, Tom has met my wife. It's okay.
Oh, okay. Okay. But anyway, as I take a sip of it, so I picked up, as you alluded to, Cigar City Brewing Company, which oddly is available in Northwest Ohio in the winter.
They're getting big.
Yeah, I think so. But this is the Guayabera Citra Pale Ale, so Citra hops, right, in it.
Mm-hmm.
Really nice. You know, not an IPA by any means. It's just a pale. It's got a little bit of that Citra hop flavor to it. It's really, really good.
Excellent.
And what about you, Heady Topper Boy?
Well, I, as you have alluded to, I am drinking what I would consider to be the OG of dank beers. It is the Alchemist Heady Topper. As best I am aware, it is only available in Vermont. It's good. It's very good. It's not great, but it is very good. And it is... As far as I'm concerned, the definition of a dank New England IPA. It is the New England IPA. And it's wonderful. And I have friends who were in Vermont a couple weeks ago, and I've actually been in Vermont since then, but I wasn't able to pick any up, but they brought some back for me, and it was wonderful. So I'm drinking the last of them, and it's just delightful. I would highly recommend, if anyone's not sure what we mean when referring to a dank New England IPA, get yourself some Alchemist, specifically the Heady Topper, and you will know. This is the definition of that.
So I have to – I've never had that, but there is a Michigan brewery that it's escaping me. There is the one version that's an M43, and then they have a double that's something else. And that is the dankest IPA I've had ever.
It's hard to tell because I've not had that and you've not had this, so I don't know how we can really compare them to each other.
Exactly.
But all the more reason for you to come to Fine Woodworking Live 2021.
That's right.
Mark your calendars now.
That's right.
You should.
We'll see if my marathon doesn't get postponed till then.
You could run all the way to Massachusetts.
I could.
Yes.
So sorry, when I stepped away, I got that drill in. That drill. There you go. That's similar. But mine's an 18 volt. So both of these are 18 volts, but the one is the old Bosch Brute 18 volt. Can you hear how tired that is?
It does sound sleepy.
It's sleepy. And this is actually the Impactor little much smaller grip, by the way. The handles are completely different between the two tools, but that's a twist in my hand, high torque, little jobby.
This is because I love the listeners. That was Milwaukee 12 volt power.
Yep, and you know what? I push it with my index finger to go forward, and with my thumb to go backward. Yep. Like God intended.
Check out the Modern Woodworkers Association Instagram story where I showed the push button on the top of this one and the light that in the fluorescently lit garage I'm in right now is easily visible. But I promise you it is not visible in daylight.
Is that the one that my wife liked?
I don't know. Did she? I'll check.
Well, could be.
It was a story, and I didn't see a notification from her.
Oh, maybe not.
With the stories.
So you posted a video of your...
My beer.
Your scroll saw. No, in your...
Oh, yeah, the Bosch, yeah. And then commenting about the microphones. Yes, that was my pre-podcast humor.
There you go. I'll listen to that later.
All I can say is that your wife has good taste.
There you go. When you were posting that, I was picking up pizza.
Oh, fine. I have to go inside and figure out dinner.
There you go. Yeah,
me too. You guys eat late. Holy crap, Diaby.
I got home from work. I fed my children. I took care of them, and I came out here and I podcasted.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I was in the shop. I came up and went, oh, crap, and ate an apple and a muffin, and yep.
That's probably why I'm so punchy, because I haven't eaten.
Yeah, probably. And I'm on my fourth beer. How about you?
I'm only on my second.
Yeah.
Second water for me.
Anyway,
well, with all that fun information for the listeners, where can folks find you on the interwebs, Diaby?
Well, I can be found at penultimatewoodshop.com. I can be found at Diaby Plotky on Twitter. Allegedly, according to this, in the show notes, you can find me on Facebook. You can find me at Penultimate Woodshop on Instagram. You can find me on Penultimate Beer on Untappd. And 2 hours and 5 minutes into the podcast, you can find me talking about where I am.
All right. Sean, how about you?
I am at SeanW78, or just SeanW78, on most social medias, including Untappd and Instagram. So you can find me there. Kyle, how about you?
Well, you can always find me at Bart.Kyle on Instagram, the only social media platform.
And that just about wraps up this show. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on the podcatcher of your choice. Just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association. There you'll never miss any of our exciting episodes, like this one. While you're there, please leave us a review.
If you're listening to us, odds are you're subscribed. If you're one of the people who are listening without subscribing, get off your butt and subscribe, please. But assuming you're one of the people who have subscribed, you know another woodworker in person. Maybe only one, depending on where you are. If you don't have a local guild, it's a rather isolating and solitary hobby. But talk to the other guy you know, or the gal you know, or the youth you know, and tell them to subscribe, please. Because what could be better than 2 hours, 6 minutes, and 42 seconds of us just kind of meandering about our interpersonal relationships and power tools? So all that being said, Kyle... I'm lost. I'm going to need to edit this. This is really terrible. I apologize.
You're lost. You're done.
Yeah. Did you give your, you did, cause I muted you. So you did give your outgoing thing.
Yes.
So then
we're done.
I'll cut all this out and I will simply end with the fact that one of the least appreciated cordless power tools is the cordless heat gun, which if all you do is make rectangular furniture, you will find no use for. But if you use epoxy or dye or like to shape plastic parts, the cordless heat gun is a really cool tool. And since it doesn't have to connect to a vacuum, it makes complete sense.
Hmm. The only cordless tool in my shop is a drill.